Okay, I think we're gonna get going again here. We're gonna sort of, I was sort of playing with the different ideas to chat about in the last kind of lecture here. But I kind of wanted to sort of, just sort of kind of explore a few key issues raised by emerging technologies that I think are gonna kind of shape, or at least should shape, the public discussion for the years that are gonna come. And so I really kind of, in this section, want to circle back on some of the things that we've already discussed over the course of the lectures, and so we can have some kind of broad themes to think about. So to kind of start, I wanted to kind of do a thought experiment where we're going to sort of look at this idea that Earth was suddenly invaded by a strange alien species, right? And the purpose of this thought experiment is to kind of get us thinking about a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about with artificial intelligence. So, and taking our jobs and, you know, re-sort of jigging the employment picture. And so imagine, as I said, we were suddenly invaded by an alien species. So as they arrive, you know, we've all seen the movies, humanity realizes that this species hasn't come to conquer. They've come only to work. So it seems like sort of a benign, positive invasion, does it not, right? These aliens, they come, they just want to work. That's all they want to do. So, like, what are their characteristics? They're all from the worker caste. They are very sort of comparable to us. They've got good language skills, problem-solving skills. They even exhibit a certain level of creativity. But they're really just driven by one biological imperative, and that is that fulfillment comes only through performing work, productive work. They've got no concept of private property, personal space, wealth creation. They've got no concept of social prestige. They don't care about that. They can sleep at work. They reproduce asexually. And they achieve maturity in only a couple of months. They don't care what food they eat or drink. They have no sort of sense of taste. They have no desire to stand out and sort of show themselves as an individual. They seek only to serve the colony. The sole cost of their potential employment is sort of a type of food, you know, like water, whatever. Like I said, they have no taste. So if they were only here to just work, how do you think that owners of businesses would react to these aliens who would come? What do you guys think? Yeah?
Well, looking at, you know, Ford.
Yeah.
Raised the wages of his workers so they could buy his vehicles.
Oh yeah. And so you don't think that they would hire these aliens that all they wanted to do is work?
Well, I think there's.
And you didn't have to pay them anything.
I think, you know, the early adopters, if you will do it from the standpoint of greed.
Okay.
But I mean, Ford was outstanding in terms of being a bleeding edge of the horseless carriage.
Right.
He did go on that. Charitable view, albeit enlightened from, you know, paying his workers more.
Right.
There's another version of this that's playing out interestingly in this decade, which is Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
They've got influx of foreign workers doing all the work that the royal class doesn't want to touch.
Right.
But these people are underemployed.
Mm-hmm.
Now you get into, well, what are you doing with yourself? That gets into, you know, what is fulfilling for them.
Right.
So far, they're getting paid to do nothing.
Right. So, I mean, the reason why I wanted to sort of present this thought experiment was that, you know, based on a lot of the things that we've been chatting about, you know, you got to ask yourself, and my premise is that these foreign aliens would be hired en masse. Okay? So in this kind of a world, you know, unemployment would start to skyrocket, right? Incomes of those with jobs would stagnate because the competition for these last remaining jobs would really remain massively fierce. And really in this world, like, the calls on government to start to do something would really kind of multiply, right? You could say, okay, well, look, like, people are losing their jobs. Government, you've got to do something. You know, the idea here would be that conservatives would kind of say, look, like, you know, everyone else in the world is hiring these aliens, so we need to also hire them. Maybe liberals would say something like, look, we've got to think about our people who are losing their jobs. And You know, in fact, I think the public would really become fearful about the future, right? So consumer markets would really become, yep, more...
What if we program these aliens so that they're also motivated to make humans comfortable, so that they produce
right.
enough natural resources, like
yeah.
they produce enough market for humans to eat properly,
mm-hmm.
and so humans don't need to have a salary anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to chat about that a little more. I'm just kind of using this as just sort of like an idea, because I want to really demonstrate a larger point, which is that why is it that we're looking at automation technology, like artificial intelligence technologies, robotics, et cetera, why are businesses wanting to employ these types of technologies, right? It's to cut costs, right? It's to increase profitability, right? When you use, in my case, I guess maybe the analogy that I was using wasn't as clear as it could have been, but when you use an alien that, or a machine that doesn't, you know, need to be paid and can be just inserted and all they want to do is work, I mean, it's quite clear that, you know, costs can be cut, you know, in that scenario. But what I'm just trying to do is kind of paint a more broad picture of what this can lead to, right? That impetus to replace human labor, what it actually leads to, right? So, you know, in this kind of a scenario, you know, many businesses that produce non-essential goods and services essentially begin to fall off, because when people start losing their jobs, their disposable income goes down, and therefore they actually can't consume any of the products that are being produced, right? So what we have is, that, you know, an alien invasion or an invasion of robots that doesn't end up being very benign at all, right? This is kind of at the extreme level of the spectrum. But what I'm sort of proposing and suggesting here is that the world is actually starting to look like this. And so this is really the main problem, and I think that that's what you were getting at, and that's also what you were getting at, especially when you said, hey, look, I think, well, we would hire more people, we would increase wages, right? I mean, to get to that thought, you know, we've been stressing the fact that accelerating technological development and adoption is likely to increasingly threaten jobs across skill levels, right? So if such a trend develops, which we do maintain that it will, the implications for the overall economy is what I kind of want to look at, right? So as shown in the thought experiment, as jobs and incomes continue to relentlessly be automated away, if we can assume that that is going to happen, the bulk of consumers may eventually come to lack the income and purchasing power necessary to drive demand that is critical to sustained economic growth. So every product and service produced by the economy ultimately gets purchased by someone. In economic terms, demand means a desire or a need for something, backed by the ability and willingness to pay for it. So if we look at where demand comes from in an economy, you know, for goods and services, it's really either government or individuals. So if you look at a typical economy, and that's why I have this up there, consumers and consumption typically make up about 2/3 of GDP. So this is the United States, you can see it's around 70%. So businesses, you know, they do buy things, but that's not final demand. Businesses buy things to make investments that will enable future production. If there's no demand for what a business is producing, then it will shut down and stop producing inputs, right? So the essential point is that a worker is also a consumer and may support other consumers. These people drive final demand. When a worker is replaced by a robot, the robot doesn't go out and consume, right? So the robot in an auto manufacturing plant will not be running if no one's buying cars. I mean, this is a perfect example with the Ford thing, right? So if automation eliminates a substantial fraction of jobs that consumers rely on, or if wages are driven so low that very few people have significant discretionary income, then it's difficult to see how our current mass modern sort of market economy could continue to thrive. Yep.
I just want to add to the robots don't consume bit. There's
yep.
a good anecdote in Martin Ford's Rise of the Robots. It's
this is where I took that thought experiment from.
Yes,
yep.
indeed. But one of the anecdote he uses is Henry Ford II, so Junior. And Walter Reuter, they're in a new auto factory, and I'm assuming in Michigan, somewhere in Michigan, you know, producing Ford, and it's newly automated as well, so there are no more workers. Ford, he taunts Reuter, goes, Reuter, how are these How are these machines going to pay your union dues? And Walter starts back going, Ford, how are they going to buy your cars?
Yeah, and so that's really the point that we're trying to get at, is that all the major industries that form the backbone of the economy, right? So auto manufacturing, financial services, consumer electronics, telecommunication, healthcare, all this kind of stuff, they're geared towards markets consisting of many millions of potential customers, right? So markets are driven by aggregate dollars, but also by unit demand. So a single wealthy person can only consume so much. They can only buy so many cars, they can only buy so many TVs, they can only buy so many smartphones, right? And so in a mass market economy, the distribution of purchasing power among consumers matters a great deal. So extreme concentration among a tiny sliver of potential customers will ultimately threaten the viability of markets that support these industries. So another thing I just wanted to note is that, you know, I want to mention something on productivity, right? So we've looked at the fact that, you know, consumption, on behalf of consumers through the salary that they're earning through wages is really what drives an economy in their current state forward, right? We can chat about other models and things like that, but I want to just drive this point home that what's really going on when automation technologies are pushing people out of their jobs is that it's really just eating into consumer purchasing power, right? And so, you know, I wanted to say something about productivity. So if machines and software were indeed substituting for human labor at such a rapid clip, you would expect the number of hours worked to fall precipitously, right? And productivity to soar. But the problem with this assumption is that in the real economy, things aren't that simple, right? So productivity doesn't measure how much a business could produce per hour. It measures how much a business actually does produce. In other words, productivity is directly influenced by demand. And so, like, think of a service business. Like, this is what most of our economy is, right? So let's say there's weak demand because, I don't know, for some reason people don't have the money to pay for, I don't know, some type of service that we have in the economy, right? So, for example, restaurants, right? Like, people aren't going out to eat as much anymore because, you know, their wages are going down or they're having trouble finding full-time work or they're out of work completely, right? So in this kind of a situation, it's likely that, you know, poor productivity growth is going to occur unless immediately there are cuts to the workforce or you reduce worker hours like right away. So this kind of happens across the economy where companies of all sizes, where sort of, you know, one firm may be increasing productivity with the use of technology while another is sort of cutting output in response to a slack in demand. And so averaged together, you kind of get poor overall productivity. And as you can see in the United States right now, productivity has actually never been so low for so long. This is where we stand right now. And it's interesting because when you think that automation and you hear about it, this is another sort of long-term chart here looking at US productivity. It's actually been flat, or not flat, but declining since around 2002. As you can see here, global financial crisis coming down in here. So it's kind of interesting. Also, when we talk about consumer demand, right, this is what I'm trying to emphasize here. If you actually look at the S&P 500, which is a list of the 500 largest companies in the United States by market capitalization, if you actually look at their sales growth, because I mentioned as well, when demand is decreasing, you know, sales growth doesn't happen as well, top line revenue growth. So since roughly 2010, you see that sales growth amongst the largest companies in the United States has been decreasing. So what I'm trying to paint a picture of is that this automation revolution that's going on, this artificial intelligence revolution, is already starting to do what I sort of painted a picture of with that alien invasion. It's already happening. So as advancing technology continues to drive inequality in both income and consumption, it can eventually undermine the vibrant and broad-based market demand that is essential for continued prosperity in the current capitalist system. So consumer markets play a critical role not just in supporting current economic activity, but also in advancing the overall process of innovation. So while individuals or teams generate new ideas, it is ultimately consumer markets that create the incentive for innovation. So this is important. What I'm trying to drive home here is that consumers decide which new ideas succeed and which are destined to fail. It's sort of like this wisdom of the crowds function in capitalism, which essentially It's this process through which the best innovations rise above the rest and ultimately scale across the economy and society. So where there's a common, there's like a commonly held belief that business investment is focused on like a long-term future, right? So it's kind of independent of short-term current consumption patterns, but that's actually wrong, because if you look at statistics from all the major recessions since 1940, business investment has actually scaled back each time. Meaning that, in other words, tepid consumer demand today can essentially rob us of our prosperity in the future. And so this is where there's like an automation paradox. So in an environment where consumers are continuing to struggle, which they are right now, painted a few pictures there, many businesses will be inclined to focus on cutting costs rather than expanding markets. So one of the few bright spots for investment at present will be labor-saving technologies leading to further reductions in consumer demand. And this is what I'm talking about. This is a paradox. This is that feedback loop, right? Where, so right now, consumer demand is dictating that top-line sales growth, as I mentioned, as I showed in that chart, isn't growing. People are not consuming all the things that these businesses are producing. And so that's why you're seeing automation technology, artificial intelligence, you know, being deployed to displace humans, because what that does is, in theory, it improves productivity and therefore increase profits by cutting costs. But what I'm saying is that there's a natural limit to that, right? So what we could actually end up with is a lot of job-seeking robots, but less of the broad-based innovation that actually improves the overall quality of our lives. So there may, in fact, be natural limits to how far research in artificial intelligence, automation, and robotics technology actually goes, built into the system, just because the consumer will always have an impact on what demand is being generated and therefore what businesses will invest in to meet that demand. So I talk about the power the consumer still has in this economy, right? So this is what I'm kind of talking about, making that, talking about that loop, right? So the development of both advanced AI, so super intelligence, nanotechnology, other sort of high-end stuff, are going to require enormous investment in research and development. However, long before such genuinely advanced technologies become practical, as we've outlined, more specialized forms of artificial intelligence are likely to threaten vast numbers of jobs at a variety of skill levels. So we talk about artificial general intelligence, artificial super intelligence, and then we talk about artificial narrow intelligence, which is the artificial sort of the AI that we're using today. So artificial narrow intelligence would be like a robotic arm, you know, working on a factory floor instead of actually using a human being. Right, so what I'm proposing is that these basic sort of narrow forms of artificial intelligence and robotics that we're using now to displace labor are going to essentially, in a short period of time, or at least what's going on right now, displace enough workers to perhaps have an impact on consumption. And if people are less interested in consuming what businesses are producing, what I'm suggesting is that all of that massive expenditure in research and R&D, which would go into developing artificially super intelligent innovations and other sort of more sophisticated advancements, may naturally be curbed because consumers are just unable to provide that demand needed for businesses to invest. Yeah?
However, human beings are also adaptable, so mm-hmm. they're not going to stay in the same stage. They are going to learn all the technologies that they
right.
have.
So we chatted a little bit about that in the first lecture. Basically, there's, in the short term, almost like a, I guess you could say, a period of, I can't remember the specific term that I used, but there's a period of time where there's more of the jobs that are available are jobs that people aren't necessarily have the skills to fill, but we just, all we have to do is get past that gap, and then, you know, people will find that new employment that they can move to so that they can start consuming again, and the system goes on and on and on and on. That's possible. I hope that that's the case, but what I'm kind of raising, and based on some of the research that I've done, that gap may actually exist far longer than we think it will. I mean, I chatted about education and lifelong education in the second lecture, and what I actually found was that a lot of the more modern skills that are in demand in this economy, this sort of high-tech economy, are skills that are only kind of available for people that are already very educated, right? They're not necessarily, like, retraining the truck driver to all of a sudden understand advanced robotics is, like, very unlikely, right? And so what I'm talking about is like a large segment of the population that retraining may actually not be as feasible as we might think. Yep.
The other problem with that is the fact, like, you have to ask if this new technology is going to create more or as many jobs as it had destroyed, as had previous technologies done.
Right.
There's one allegory I really, really like. It's called the Luddite horse allegory. And it's about two horses talking to each other at the turn of the century, and they're talking about new technologies. And so, like, I think the horse population peaked in 1915, and since then it's only been downhill. And that's because of, you know, new technologies that showed up, like the car and tractor and so on and so forth. Like, there was no more need for a horse to continue any of the work it did, and there was no way for it to be able to pay for its hay and housing.
Right.
So, same thing today, what we see with AI is we see robots move from what would be called, like muscle machines, so machines that would have done labor, to robots doing thinking jobs, so being able to actually do the receptionist and the secretary.
Yeah, and remember, in our developed economies, we are basically service economies, right? So, I mean, when we talk about knocking out the lowest on the low in terms of the totem pole, right? So automating like truck driving functions or like the robotic arm, like I mentioned, on a factory floor. I mean, we're talking about service economies where we've moved to now, where the majority of people are doing sort of, you know, administrative tasks. There's some cognitive stuff, there's some analytical stuff, there's communication stuff as well. But what I'm talking about is like suggesting the possibility that that gap is gonna be larger than we think, and it's gonna last for longer than we think, right? And what I'm suggesting here is that there may actually be a point where the incentive to invest further in automation technologies, and he was making a great point where he mentioned, oh, well, Ford would raise wages because he would understand that he would need people to actually buy his cars, right? That actually may occur, and that's where we talk, have this conversation that we have in the past about maybe a universal basic income, right? To help people to be able to continue to be good consumers as they retrain for their next job, right? I mean, it's possible, but what I'm sort of suggesting is that there could be almost like a fail-safe built into the system where when consumers start getting knocked out of their jobs and, you know, they're using the income from these jobs to consume products, they may, demand might slow down enough that people, that business owners like the smart Mr. Ford start saying, look, like, I'm not going to invest in any more, you know, high level, you know, artificially intelligent things to knock out more humans because there's just not going to be anybody consuming my stuff anymore. Yeah.
Government has put money into autonomous vehicles, presumably because of the safety, and and also because it's an auto industry.
Right.
So, all, you know, the incentive that government, if you think of, you know, some of the arguments about, you know, who the plumber and who built that, government puts huge amounts into R&D and
right.
so on. The investment might come from there. And,
right,
and
I see.
The government also has redistribution, a certain amount of redistribution.
Yeah, it's that's possible, but where is government getting its money? Tax, right? So if people are losing their jobs and the tax base declines massively, then like they're not going to be consuming either, right?
The 1%.
Well, so you just tax them, yeah. I mean, you suppose. I mean, there's some people like Thomas Piketty and other people that want to implement a global wealth tax, right? Where, you know, wealthy people want to pay their fair share, but there's a point at which people, wealthy people, move away when they're taxed too much, right? It happens.
But
right?
the wealthiest people are also going to lose when the consuming class disappears and nobody buys
yeah.
their stuff.
Yeah, and that's I've seen some interesting arguments about, you know, we move to a world of like techno feudalism, where, you know, if you actually look at the old feudal societies, you had, you know, the seigneur, right, who would be sort of owning the land, but they would actually need human laborers to be laboring it. Well, what if in a techno dystopia, sort of, what did I say, techno-feudalistic society, you have the owners of the means of production that actually flat out just do not need humans to do anything. So they live in like a gated community where everyone else has already lost their jobs, there's no need for human labor, there's no need for even human thought. The rich have already gotten to a point of wealth that they just don't need to bother with anybody else, and they just have robots and everything just doing everything they need in this sort of greener pastures area that's walled off from the rest. I mean, I don't hope we're not going there, but it's, you know, it's interesting to think about. Yeah?
Would it be possible to be a breakthrough in going to another planet? Because that is a lot of money also being invested. And
perhaps. Actually, SpaceX, which is Elon Musk's space company, actually just announced today that by 2018, they're going to launch a human manned flight past the moon. I don't know where he's going, but...
It's a loop.
It's a loop? Okay. Just to say that we've done it. But anyway, so no, I mean, that's interesting. So the kind of message I want to get across is that the consumer is still king, potentially, right? And I mean, we can have these different discussions and arguments about where consumption can come from. Maybe it can shift the government. Maybe it can shift the government in terms of government redistributing wealth, you know, by taxing the wealthy or something like that. But the point that I'm trying to make is that perhaps the consumption patterns of the consumer can somehow have an interesting sort of limiting impact on how much automation technologies are going to be used and therefore displace human jobs, right? And so what I kind of want to look at now is, like, what is going on with the consumer, right? Like, what is the human sort of mindset that people, the consumers, have in this new tech world, right? So what I want to kind of look at here is, you know, if we sort of consider that the consumer is still king, what world is being built around the consumer right now? Are their eyes wide open to the disruptive potential of emerging technologies? What is happening at the grassroots level? How are our minds and habits being shaped by technology? So, based on the research that I've done, and, you know, feel free to jump in or, you know, see how you feel and whatnot, but right now, it really doesn't look like the consumer is very engaged at all. It looks like more like the consumer is intent upon demanding a future where the consumer doesn't have to talk to or hear from anyone that they don't want to. So last week, Amazon actually announced that it's launching a new type of grocery store. So you walk in, you pick up the boxes of food that you want, and you walk out. Thanks to a combination of modern tracking technology, artificial intelligence, and a mobile app that has your payment information, you don't need to interact with a single other human being in order to get the sandwich or cupcake that you so desire. So on the surface, this sounds great. You know, it's a cashierless store, cuts down friction. You don't have to stand in line. You don't have to worry about exact change. You don't have to make small talk with the person in line beside you. You can just walk out without having sort of dealing with the tedium of scanning an item for yourself, right? But leaving aside the sort of profound effects that these types of stores could have on employment, it sort of hints at a growing trend that I think is going on today, where technology is really facilitating an existence for humans in which we never have to talk to, hear from, or interact with anyone that we don't want to, both in person and online. So in recent years, technology has really further enabled us to cut down on the amount of human contact that we have. We no longer need to talk on the phone anymore to order food, you know, thanks to Uber Eats and other delivery services. No longer have to talk to anybody to order a cab. No longer have to talk to customer service representatives because we've got bots and things like that. In the past, you know, we left our homes. We generally wound up having to have some kind of human interaction with people. And we're getting to the point where that no longer is the case. We're kind of shutting out what we don't want to engage with. It's also typified by our social media experience. So, you know, as it's been recently reported in the Wall Street Journal, and I'm sure you know very well, that Facebook's homepage news feed is basically run by a personalization algorithm that only feeds you information that you want to see or that it thinks you want to see. And that information is based on information that you've already consumed, right? So essentially, it shows you more of the content that you want to see and that you've already seen. I mean, this is the same with Netflix and other services that, you know, utilize algorithms to present us with content that we consume, right? So it's really just adding to confirmation bias for our beliefs, leaving us in sort of a cozy little filter bubble where, you know, we can block out the opinions and the viewpoints and the information that we don't agree with or don't want to see and only consume the information that we're interested in, right? So hearing ideas from other people that are not like you, that don't come from the same place as you, that challenge you to consider different perspectives. Like, if that isn't happening anymore, how can you learn anything? How can we have ideas that are out of the box in order to cope with the type of, you know, challenges that emerging technologies really face that we face based on emerging technologies, right? We're basically becoming digital shut-ins where we only ever engage with what's likely to make us feel better. Our ability to empathize with others, especially those who are not like us, are going to start fading as we stop engaging with one another on a person-to-person basis. This is really causing social polarization, resulting in the formation of separate groups that no longer understand each other and that find themselves increasingly at conflict with one another. In this way, personalized information can unintentionally destroy social cohesion. So this actually brings me to what we're kind of moving towards. I actually read quite an interesting book recently. I don't know if you've ever heard of a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. So the central argument of this book, and I think it goes a long way to kind of describe this technological world that we're finding ourselves in, you know, on a social level, is that there were two landmark novels that were actually written by, you know, British authors in the 30s. The first was Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, and the other one was 1984 by George Orwell. And the central tenet of the book Amusing Ourselves to Death was that Americans really kind of feared the Orwellian world, where the state was sort of like an information censoring, movement restricting, individuality emancipating type state, rather than, you know, a state in the Aldous Huxley version that is sort of, or rather not a state, but a society that's sedated by technology, that engages in massive consumption and instant gratification bubble, right? And this was in spirit the vision that Huxley predicted back in 1931. In this book by Postman, he actually wrote, and you know, I'm just going to read it out. So what Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one that wanted to read one. And I had a conversation with somebody recently. I've been asking people, I was like, what's the last book that you read from start to finish? Most people said, I don't even remember the last time I read a book from start to finish. Right? What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book because no one would want to read one, as I mentioned. Orwell feared that those who would deprive us of information, and Huxley feared those who would give us so much information that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared that we would become a trivial culture. So it's interesting because one third of a century later, you know, from when 1984 was written, that we'd be living in this Big Brother culture where everyone was always watching us and whatnot. We now carry around our own personalized screens with us at all times. I don't have my cell phone, but and rather than set, like a couple of broadcast channels, you know, and a smattering of cable, we now have a virtual infinity of options on demand that we can consume at all times. Today, the average weekly screen time for an American adult, how much time do you think an American adult spends in front of a screen entertaining themselves a week?
You're entertaining or consuming of any form?
Entertainment. How many hours? Yeah?
I think it was 68 hours.
It's 74 hours a week Americans spend in front of a screen entertaining themselves. So that's whether it's Netflix, and it's also cell phone, like, you know, Facebook, Instagram,
things
like that.
This isn't work where you're dealing with a screen.
This is entertainment.
Work.
Entertainment.
That includes televisions?
That includes televisions.
Okay.
It does.
So that's a higher number than it was when we had TVs.
That's right. Millennials check their phones roughly 100 to 157 times a day. Okay?
Every 18 minutes.
Studies show that attention spans are in decline. Studies show that attention spans are in decline. Can serious national issues such as the impact of artificial intelligence and automation and robotics, can it seriously be debated in any coherent and meaningful way in such a fragmented, attention-challenged environment? Especially the kinds of policies that we've been discussing. So our public discourse has been, as Huxley would say, trivialized. It's astounding that we still cling to the word debates for what our presidential candidates do on stage when facing each other, right? Who can be shocked of the rise of a reality TV star, a man given to loud inflammatory statements, many of which are spectacularly untrue, but virtually all of which make for exceptionally good television? So the problem is that instead of remaining alert and informed, today's consumer seems to be stuck in his or her own echo chamber, content to consume the next familiar soundbite suggested by their friendly algorithm. As I said, personalized information builds a filter bubble around us, a kind of digital prison for our thinking. How could creativity and thinking out of the box be possible in such conditions? So the question is, can we make it out? The problem is that in an Orwellian world where everybody's controlled overtly, you know, they're in a prison, let's say, and they're always watched on camera, it's easy to recognize and oppose such a disruptive world. The problem with the Huxleyan world that we talk about here is that who is really prepared to take up arms against a sea of amusements and distractions? So I want to kind of conclude with just a few other thoughts about the consumer and just about sort of where we're moving. So in the future, and even to a greater extent now, it's entirely possible that your day will involve only interacting with humans that you want to. And even those interactions won't necessarily involve much actual human contact. In the near future, through automation, you could leave your home and return that night having potentially only interacted in person with your coworkers. It's not even that hard to do today, but it's going to get a lot easier when there are fewer people required to run stores, ferry people from place to place, or answer the phone for a company. It's worth considering how much we really need technology to do for us, or what we can really do for ourselves. Chance encounters, thoughts entirely different from our own, spontaneity, they'll all dwindle as we become further entrenched in our predetermined, tech-facilitated life loops. So to end things for our lecture series, I wanted to leave you with a few interesting theories that pose some fascinating existential questions. So I actually read an interesting book recently, a new book by Yuval Harari. It's a book called Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tehran. And this guy's a historian. He's done a lot of work looking at, this kind of ideas about the future, futurism, this kind of stuff. And he actually goes so far as to suggest that we may become so dependent on these new technological tools that our species will become irrelevant, our value determined only by the data that we generate. He actually predicts the emergence of two religions, and this is kind of interesting. So the first religion is techno-humanism. So I mentioned this kind of earlier, I hinted at it in the lecture, which kind of sees technology as always a positive thing. The more technology we add, the better. But it also sort of does recognize that humans are still the center of authority in the universe, right? So this is the kind of school that says that if we can somehow merge with technology as a human, then things will really improve for the better, right? So these are people like Ray Kurzweil, other sort of high-end executives at Google also, who are developing ways to essentially eradicate death. They want to live forever. They want to sort of use technology to augment their human capabilities. But then there's a second religion that I think is really interesting, and that is dataism. And this is kind of a new ethical system that says, yes, humans were special and important because up until now they were more sophisticated data. They were the most sophisticated data processing system in the universe. But this is no longer the case. The tipping point is when you have an external algorithm that understands you, your feelings, your emotions, your choices, your desires, better than you understand them yourself. That's the point when there is the switch from amplifying humans to making them redundant. Shifting decision-making to an algorithm, you lose your own authority in a way. We become less important, perhaps irrelevant. In the past humanist age, the value of an experience came from within yourself. In the dataist age, meaning is generated by the external data processing system. So, for example, you go to a Japanese restaurant and you have a delicious dinner, you eat some sushi or whatever it is, right? The thing to do is take a picture of the dish on your phone and put it on Facebook or Instagram, right? And see how many likes you get. If you don't share your experiences in this world, they don't become part of the data processing system, and they therefore have no meaning. In the future, when you talk about politics, God, or religion, it really has to do with authority. So in this new sort of dataist way of understanding things, What is the highest source of authority that you turn to when you have a problem in your life? Well, in the past, you know, you'd turn to the church. Maybe you'd turn to God. But today we expect algorithms to provide us with the answer. Who to date, where to live, how to deal with an economic problem. So more and more authority is shifting to these corporations who control the data, the algorithm, and thus the user experience of the consumer. One of our most important inventions that is spreading right now is biometric sensors. So they become ubiquitous, and we're going to be living in a world where you're actually going to consult your biometric data to figure out how to live. So we talk about nanobots, like tiny little bots that essentially can enter into the human blood system, and they're actually going to basically be able to read exactly your biometric data and tell you, you know, what kind of decision you want to make. So this is kind of a very scary thing, right? So for example, I would be trying to decide whether to have, you know, chicken or fish for dinner, right? And the nanobots in my head would tell me that the fish would actually give me more happiness if I had the fish, right? Does it really make me more happy? Over time, my decisions have actually been reduced to brain signal readers, right? So I, in this scenario, am not special or sacred or even an individual. I'm actually just a vessel for a bunch of signals that are read by a computer. There's no room for me in this arrangement anymore. So beyond this, a kind of social control is also being planned. So according to recent reports, every Chinese citizen will receive a so-called citizen score, which will determine under what conditions they may get loans, jobs, or travel visas to other countries. This kind of individual monitoring would include people's internet surfing and other behavior, and their social contacts as well. And this is sort of an example of this offloading of human agency to data, right? So what's really starting to happen, and what's going to become more apparent with the onset of these types of advanced technologies, is that there's actually no self, no freedom, there's no free will. It's not that you understand your true self better through the use of data and algorithms, but you come to realize that there is no true self. There is just a complicated connection of biochemical connections without a core. There is no authentic voice that lives inside you. It's just sort of like an interesting thought experiment, I think, to sort of wonder if we get reduced to simply biochemical signals within our bodies that algorithms tell us, you know, you should have this course of action or you should have that course of action. So some software platforms are even moving towards persuasive computing. In the future, using sophisticated manipulation technologies, these platforms will be able to steer us through entire courses of action, be it for the execution of complex work processes or to generate free content for internet platforms. The trend goes from programming computers to programming people. And this, I believe, is the most sad part about the onset of artificial intelligence, robotics, and other next-generation technology. The messy, unpredictable pain and pleasure of life are at risk of being removed by technology. The beauty and the charm of chance. Sterile emptiness is creeping into our lives. We're taking less risks. We're less willing to commit and less willing to experience disappointment. We're becoming more self-absorbed and guarded. And we are starting to feel it. Suicide rates across the developed world right now are at record highs. Reports of loneliness and depression are at record highs, in addition to substance abuse are at record highs. The question is can we opt out of this world? What can we do? The simplest answer is that it is becoming more and more difficult. It has to do with healthcare to a large part, right? Which will increasingly rely on internet-connected sensors. People will be willing to give up their privacy and willing to connect to the grid in exchange for medical services that can tell you on the first day a cancer cell starts spreading in your body. So connectivity is booming, and going off the grid is getting more and more difficult all the time. Yet an industry is actually developing around disconnecting and de-teching. The offline world is actually becoming a luxury. So I actually read a report recently, which was quite interesting, in hospitality and tourism, which shows that disconnection vacations are becoming a huge thing. People are actually paying extra money to go to hotels that do not have Wi-Fi connection, that are completely off the grid. So I think people are starting to wake up to the kind of more alarming aspects of this connected world that we're moving towards. So this is where, kind of where I want to leave you today. The technology of today and tomorrow that we discuss over the course of these lectures, they're not inherently good nor bad. What matters is how they are understood, used, and managed. This is a question of values, and thus will require openness and respect for a diversity of opinions. I talked about openness in my second lecture as a necessary sort of principle that we're going to need to address these types of issues moving forward. But it really kind of remains to be seen whether future generations will confirm that there's something fundamentally human about valuing the offline world, the natural world, and the true interpersonal connectivity and the freedom that it actually can offer. So humanity has proven its ability to rise to the challenges posed by dangerous technologies. In the 1950s and 60s, as I mentioned, there was a real fear that during the Cold War would actually end in nuclear holocaust. That didn't happen. After thousands of years in which war seemed to be an inevitable part of human nature, we changed how international politics functioned, and as you know, no two democracies have ever gone to war with one another, and violent conflict around the world has actually been on the decrease. So, you know, I hope we'll also be able to rise to the challenge of artificial intelligent technologies, robotics, genetic engineering, and some of the other developments that we've been chatting about. We may need a completely new economic model, as I've been showing, you know, with the consumer demand issues that robotics face. But one thing that I hope we were able to convey across these three lectures is that the margin of error this time is very low. So let's hope that humanity again can rise to the occasion. And thanks a lot for coming out. Appreciate it. If I presented a few thought-provoking ideas.
Thought-provoking, and I have to say, on that scary idea, too.
Yeah.
I really would like to thank Matthew, and what about Monsieur Jean-Gabriel? He left?
Monsieur Jean-Gabriel.
Ah, voilà. I was wondering, I felt, did we lose you? I really would like to take really a moment to thank Monsieur Gabriel, for taking us through this very fascinating journey last 3 weeks. We've learned a great deal, and I'm sure the participants who came last 3 weeks learned a great deal as well. Maybe the discussion and the conversation, Matthew and Jean-Gabriel, has just begun, I think, on the subject and the interest you generated. It's just a food for thought, and it's the first conversation of many weeks and months and years perhaps to come. On behalf of the Glendon School of Public Administration, Public and International Affairs, we have un petit cadeau.
Ah, c'est gentil.
Will...
Nanobots, maybe?
For you, we would like to thank you. I really like to thank the audience who came 3 weeks in a row. The numbers kind of dwindled, increased, decreased. But as I said, I'm sure there'll be many other conversations to come. I would also like to mention that part of the Glendon Global debates, we have our, for this year at least, for this semester, a final discussion on March 23, where we will be discussing another interesting topic. You have the flyers with you on Canada-EU trade agreement. It's a slightly different format, that one. It's more of a debate where we have five experts and really a variety of backgrounds, Europeans, Canadians, union representatives, to really doing the laying the onions to really look deeper into the Canada-EU trade agreement, CETA. So please do come and join us. It starts at 6:30. There's a small reception. The panel discussion starts at 7 p.m. March 23. Thursday.
Will it be here?
No, it's in the main hall. Exactly. As you just come in. And thank you so much again. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Un
grand merci.
And I think our emails are on those sheets. So if you want to chat about the materials or you'd like a coffee or something, I'm happy to chat with you about that. Thanks a lot. And if you have any questions, if anyone wants to ask, happy to answer.
And I'd like to thank the organizers of
the
event as well, Andréane and Marion, who worked diligently.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great.
Anne?